further introduction, we're going to ask him to lead our thoughts.
Well, good morning, everybody. We're going to start by saying something I'm sure you'll probably agree with. Many people today are not sure whether they can totally trust the claims of the Bible, and you may be amongst that group. And when you stop and look at what the Bible claims, one of its key claims is that it's been written over thousands of years, and yet it still has one author behind it, the same author, and that's God. In fact, some people consider the Bible is really just a great hoax. It's been put together by a few men, and it's just pretending to contain a divine message. But what if it's not? What if it really is God's message to us, full of relevance and help? You see, if you take the time to read the Bible, it claims to contain a message of the utmost importance. And part of that claim is that it can give meaning and purpose to your life, can answer the big questions we have about our lives. It claims to give reliable information about what happens to us when we die and whether there's life after death. And then there's also the claim that it can help us have advice for how we just go about our day-to-day living. And obviously we know how challenging that can be, so some help would be useful, wouldn't it? But what if you're in a position where you doubt? You doubt that the Bible is actually a book you can trust. If that's the case, I'm sure you would say, well, I'd like you to give me some good reasons why I can trust the Bible. Give me some evidence to support some of those claims. And I'm sure you'd want that evidence to be clear and direct. And that's why we're going to turn this morning to a consideration of archaeology and the Bible. And if we stop and look at what archaeology is, then we find that archaeology is in fact the systematic study of past human life and culture. It's done by recovering, examining material that's left behind, evidence such as graves, buildings, tools and pottery, not quite in the Indiana Jones style of archaeology. Archaeology is about precious discoveries. Sometimes they're only precious in regard to the material things that they're made from, you might say. They're gold, they're silver, they're precious jewels. But really what's precious about them is the value is there in what they tell us about the past, how they reveal things about the past to us. And what we want to do is ask this question: can then archaeology help us to decide if the Bible is really an accurate record of history, for example? Was it really written during the historical periods it claims to belong to? Does it really contain accurate historical details? Because if it does that, then perhaps we can trust the things that are alongside that. And we're not convinced it's just a hoax put together by a few people over a few years. Now, the interesting thing is that over the years, Bible critics have doubted the existence of many of the peoples and the places that are mentioned in the Bible. And the reason they did that was because there seemed to be no other reliable records, no other evidence to suggest that these places had existed, these people had existed. Any mention of them. And then it was assumed, therefore, that because there was no other source than the Bible, it must simply mean that the nations, the cities, the kings, the conflicts that are there in the biblical narrative, they must be fictional. What a lot of people don't realise is that archaeological work over the last 200 years or so has thrown up a great deal of evidence for the Bible as an accurate historical record. And it's those precious discoveries that we want to consider alongside the Bible record and what it says. And then, just by taking a few examples of that, I want to leave it with you to think about the implications of that and to decide whether you're going to draw a certain set of conclusions from that. So we're going to begin with a very well-known biblical king. We're going to treat this a little bit like a case study in which we're going to see how the Bible's account of history is questioned, even now after 200 years of archaeological work. So the Bible character we want to consider is one that most people will have heard of. It's the man David. Now, David is probably best known, even if you haven't really read your Bible, for slaying the giant Goliath who struck fear into the army of Israel. I think there's even an ad campaign at the moment using it, LucasAid, isn't there? Very inaccurately, but there we go. Now, according to the biblical record, this man David was also the second human king of Israel. He was therefore the founder of a long dynasty of Israelite monarchs. The New Testament also makes lots of references to him, particularly as a significant member, ancestor of the family tree of Jesus. And we know how important Jesus is to the Bible. But David is mentioned over 1,000 times in the Bible. So I think from this we can conclude that David is a key figure in Bible history. And the more we study the Bible, the more we realise that he is a key figure in its overall message. However, it's argued that there is no evidence outside the Bible that such a man ever existed, let alone founded a dynasty of kings in Israel back in the 11th century BC. Just share a few examples of that with you. So here's one by a man called P. Kyle MacArthur. He writes, "The Bible is our only source of information about David. No ancient inscription mentions him. No archaeological discovery can be securely linked to him. We cannot assume, therefore, that a statement about David in a given part of the Bible derives from an early source. The David of Chronicles, for example, is the idealized David of the Second Commonwealth, not the David of history." So he's basically saying, we don't really have any reason to believe this man ever really existed. And just to show that's not an unusual state of affairs, here's another man, Thomas L. Thompson, who writes, "We do not have evidence for the existence of kings named Saul, David, or Solomon. Nor do we have evidence for any temple at Jerusalem in this early period. What we do know of Israel and Judah in the 10th century does not allow us to interpret this lack of evidence as a gap in our knowledge and information about the past, a result merely of the accidental nature of archaeology. There is neither room nor context, no artifact or archive that points to such historical realities in Palestine's 10th century. And this is poignant, I think he says, stories are not enough. And I think that is how certain Bible critics will put this forward. This idea. It's just, the Bible is just full of stories. So let's have a look at something that has been discovered, and it's known to most people as the Tel Dan inscription. Now, in the summer of 1993, a fragment of an ancient stele was discovered at this place called Tel Dan. Tel means mound of Dan. This is an archaeological site in Israel, in the Upper Galilee region next to the Golan Heights. And the site is quite securely identified with the biblical city of Dan. Now, you can see it's sort of a fragmented piece, and if we just look at another picture of it, you can see that the fragments have been sort of labelled. Fragment A, the biggest fragment, was discovered accidentally in a stone wall near a related archaeological dig. Then further fragments, B1 and B2, which fit together, were discovered in 1994. Now the stele was apparently broken into pieces at some point and later used in a construction project at Tel Dan, presumably by Hebrew builders. We'll come to why that's presumed in a moment. Now the fragments are inscribed with, in the Middle Eastern language, it's known as Aramaic. And although much of the text is missing, as you can tell, certain key names and phrases are clear. If we look at a line-by-line translation, we notice mention of certain things amongst it. There's mention of a king of Israel, the house of David, and several references to Hadad and a name. But if you just sort of skim through it, you'll also see that the writer of this steel is boasting of his military achievements against the king of Israel. Now, the Bible talks several times of war between Israel and Syria, and it mentions the Syrian kings who had the royal title Ben-Hadad, and that means the son of Hadad. So just a couple of examples, one taken from the historical book in the Bible, 1 Kings, chapter 20. And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his hosts together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria and warred against it. Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel at that time. And just a second example, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, all their days. So just picking up a couple of references there, we can see there was tension between the Israelites and the Syrians, and that this was obviously a recurrent problem. The Bible, in fact, records both Israel and Syria being victorious on different occasions in this ongoing conflict. And it would appear that the Taldan inscription is referring to one of those Syrian victories. As interesting as that is, in terms of supporting the Bible as a narrative, what's more significant to us is this reference within the fragment to the house of David. Now, it's just worth remembering a few things that were claimed. The Bible is our only source of information about David. No ancient inscription mentions him. No archaeological discovery can be securely linked to him. And we don't have evidence for the existence of kings named Saul, David, or Solomon. But here we do have an artifact that surely is evidence of David's original existence, dated around 11th century BC. Because here we've got Israelite kings who were his descendants in the 9th century BC. And that is, again, something the Bible makes many references to. Just again, a couple of examples to show that. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David." So that is an Israelite referring to the house of David. And again, in 2 Chronicles, it refers to Israel rebelling against the house of David unto this day, when there was a division in the kingdom. The kingdom was divided between Israel and Judah. So there was this split. But still, the kings of David's lines were known as the house of David. And what's interesting here is that the enemies of Israel in the north, the Syrians, referred to this group of kings as the house of David. So the neighbouring nations were familiar with this term of reference. So surely the Taldan inscription does confirm the Bible record in that there was a royal line from King David that was known in these terms. Now, Professor Keith Scoville describes this artifact then in these terms. He says, "The discovery provides an archaeological connection to the biblical references to the ruling dynasty established by King David approximately 2 centuries before the events that are mentioned in the inscription. It is the first mention of King David, the earliest mention of a biblical figure outside of the Bible. The discovery is of particular importance in the face of those scholars who were either sceptical or denied the historical existence of King David." So that's quite powerful, isn't it, that he's put it in those terms. Not only does the artifact achieve this, of course, but remember, it also supports other sections of the biblical record, because it confirms that there was hostility between Syria and Israel. It uses the right sort of references for those people involved, that Ben, son of Hadad, was a title of Syrian kings involved in this hostility. So it matches up on a number of levels. Well, having spent a reasonable time just looking at one example in detail, trying to show that it sort of how precious discoveries are sort of still prodded and poked and not always believed in certain ways, want to look at a few more in a more general sense and try and build up a picture that this isn't a one-off. So the next artifact we want to think about is Sennacherib's prism, a fairly well-known one because it was discovered a long time ago. Now, the discovery of what's known as Sennacherib's prism was very significant in terms of the Bible's historical record. It relates to a time about 150 years onwards after the Tel Dan account. So we're now during the 8th century BC, if you're sort of running a timeline in your head. The prism is a six-sided clay cylinder-like document, as you perhaps can tell from the picture. It was discovered during a mid-19th century archaeological study in the ruins of Nineveh, and it was acquired by a Colonel Taylor, who was at that time living in Baghdad. The prism is now on display at the British Museum in London. You may have seen it for yourself. It's inscribed with an account of 8 military campaigns of Sennacherib, king of Assyria, hence its name. Now, in regard to the Bible, the most interesting part of the translated record from this prism states this. So the voice of Sennacherib is saying, "I then besieged Hezekiah of Judah, who had not submitted to any yoke, and I captured 46 of his strong cities and fortresses, innumerable small cities. I brought out therefrom 200,150 people. Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird, I shut up within Jerusalem, his royal city. I threw up mounds against him. I took vengeance upon any man who came forth from his city." So we get quite a graphic picture there of this campaign. Now again, if we bring our Bible alongside this and see what the Bible has to say, we again dip into the accounts of the kings in the Bible. We read this: "And in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them." So the Bible records Sennacherib's successful and highly destructive invasion of the southern kingdom of Judah, just as Sennacherib's own royal records do. And this was this period of during the 8th century BC. The Bible chapter goes on in a couple of verses' time. It says, "Then the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshakeh from Lachish," another city in Judah, "with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah." So again, there's confirmation here in the Bible record that the Assyrian siege, having destroyed all the other cities, having taken Lachish, they laid siege against Jerusalem during this very same campaign. Now, in both respects, then, we have a match, direct match, between the prism and the Bible. And there's even a reference to the tribute Hezekiah sent to Sennacherib attempting to relieve the siege. The prism and the Bible both agree that this involved 30 talents of gold. So even a little detail like that is matching up. But the Bible then goes on to give something else that's very interesting in regard to a missing detail in the prism. Bear in mind, this prism is all about Sennacherib's successful campaigns across a whole sweep of nations. But there's no claim in Sennacherib's official record to the capture of Jerusalem. Now, bear in mind that these invaders, this force from Assyria, had successfully laid siege to and captured and destroyed all the other major settlements in Judah, including that highly fortified ones. And yet, despite recording clearly a siege against this capital city of Jerusalem, no successful conclusion is mentioned in the prism. So what happens when we then look at what the Bible says? Well, the next chapter on says this: "It came to pass on a certain night that the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed." Now, if the Bible record is true, we would understand, wouldn't we, that such an embarrassing, unexpected defeat is not likely to be mentioned by Sennacherib in an official record that's boasting about all his other achievements. In many ways, if we know the minds of men and the vanity of rulers, the absence of detail in this particular point has a ring of truth about it. So again, perhaps we can see that the Sennacherib prism has something to confirm in terms of the Bible's record as a true record. it states that Sennacherib conquered all the fortified cities in Judah. And also, its lack of detail about taking Jerusalem matches up with, again, what the Bible says there about a failure to conquer that city. Let's move on again, conscious of time. We're going to move now into the 6th century BC, and a time when Jerusalem was again under threat, this time from a different empire. The empire took over from the Assyrians, the Empire of Babylon. And we want to consider this time something known as Baruch's seal. Now, literally hundreds of Hebrew seals and seal impressions have been discovered in the last century and a half, either in authorised archaeological excavations or sometimes by clandestine diggers. Now, when I'm talking about a seal, I'm talking about this sort of thing, a seal impression that you make using a ring into something. Now, in biblical Israel, papyrus was the primary form of writing material. And once you had an official document written, it would be rolled up, partially folded, and tied with a string, as you can see in the picture there. And then they take a lump of clay and put it on top of the string, and it would be impressed upon, and the upper surface of that clay would be impressed with the signet ring of someone like the owner of the document, or perhaps its writer, depending on who had a signet ring, how important that person was. Now, these sorts of official documents would then be stored in places, temples or palace archives, and that unbroken seal would be the guarantee of the validity of the document's contents. Now, the reason why so many of these clay seals have survived is due to the fact that these important buildings were sometimes destroyed by fire, usually during warfare and sieges and such things. Now, the fire would effectively fire the hardened clay anyway, the seals, and make them practically indestructible. And you can even see sometimes when you turn these seals over, if you're able to do so, that you can see the detail of the string, the cord underneath where the clay was attached to that originally on the underside of them. Occasionally you find fingerprints in them too. Now, sometime during the 1970s, a seal containing the stamp and the name of a particular scribe appeared on the antiquities market, and it was acquired by a collector, a Dr. R. Hecht. And that seal is now in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Now, the script used on this particular seal is the ancient Hebrew linear script. It was used at a particular time in Israel's history, before they were taken into exile to Babylon, a time when Jerusalem was actually captured, this time by the Babylonians, and people were deported because of that campaign. Now, that's important in terms of dating, because when they came back from their exile 70 or so years later, they'd adopted a different script, a contemporary Aramaic script, while they'd been away. So it helps us to date whether it's before the exile or after the exile which script is being used. Now, the impression upon this seal is divided by the double horizontal lines. Perhaps see them a bit more clearly in the diagram there. And into three registers they're known as, bearing the following inscription: belonging to Barachiah, son of Neriah the scribe. Now, you might be thinking, well, that's not a lot of text, and it's a very small item. How can a small piece of hardened clay lend very much support to the Bible as a historical record? But again, if we turn in our Old Testament part of the Bible, we find this record in a part of the Bible known as the prophets, in the writings of the prophet Jeremiah. So we read there in chapter 32, Jeremiah says, "And I, Jeremiah, gave the evidence of the purchase," a land purchase if we read around this verse, "the purchase unto Baruch, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, in the sight of Hanameel, mine uncle's son, and in the presence of the witnesses that subscribe the book of the purchase, before all the Jews that sat in the court of the prison." So he's describing basically an official land transfer and its documentation and having witnesses and what's going on in that situation. Now, hopefully you noted a certain name there. Here we've got a clay seal that confirms, it would seem, the reality of a man called Baruch. Baruch is a shortened version of Barachiah, just as we shorten names, so you'd use your longer name in an official document, Barakiah, but people would probably just refer to you by the shortened term in amongst other things. Here we've got a man who was the same son of Neriah, and he was a scribe and therefore would be qualified to be involved in dealing with official written records. So we seem to have evidence for a man who is just at the right sort of time in Jerusalem, the right sort of place, and is involved in the right sort of things. Interesting, isn't it? And what's particularly exciting is that we read about his involvement in other parts of Jeremiah's prophecy. Because we read in chapter 36, it came to pass in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that this word came unto Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, take thee a roll of a book, write therein all the words that I have spoken unto thee against Israel and against Judah. Then Jeremiah called Baruch, the son of Neriah, and Baruch wrote from the mouth of Jeremiah all the words of the Lord, which he had spoken unto him upon a roll of a book. Now these are the same words that we've got recorded in our Bible. So the implication is that that clay seal is evidence of who was involved in recording sections of this book for us. And part of Jeremiah's sad message was that the Babylonians were going to capture Jerusalem, were going to take them into captivity and take them away. So again, the timings match perfectly with the language being used on this seal. So we can again see, I think, that Baruch's seal is confirming the Bible's record by giving evidence of an important individual who was a scribe in Judah prior to the Babylonian exile. One more example from the Old Testament, and this one is from the same period of Judah's exile, a further connection to the Empire of Babylon. And this time we get really exciting because we're thinking about a brick. Okay, so hold yourselves back. Now, many ancient rulers had bricks inscribed with their names, which were then used in important buildings, such as palaces or in public buildings like temples or storehouses. The practice of inscribing bricks in this way provides archaeologists with valuable evidence, because they can then read the cuneiform inscriptions. And one such brick was found in the remains of the city of Babylon. In fact, many bricks were. It's the brick that's there now. It's now held in the British Museum, and it has this inscription on it. Now, Babylon was excavated by a German archaeological team headed by Robert Koldewey. And the project took place between 1899 and 1914, curtailed by the start of the First World War. So a period of 15 years they spent digging this site. Now during this time, countless bricks, as we say, were found, inscribed with the same details. They even found paving stones on a processional way through the city, chiseled with the message, I am Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon. And it's clear from the excavations that that when Nebuchadnezzar became the king of that city, he pressed forward with a gigantic rebuilding project of this important city. He practically doubled its size and fortified it in incredible ways. Now the brick we want to consider bears the simple inscription you can see translated there on the screen. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, who cares for Ezagila and Ezida, the eldest son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon. Now, again, this supports the fact there was a king called Nebuchadnezzar, and we might not doubt that now, but it was doubted hugely for many hundreds of years. And the interesting thing is that there are so many references to Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible record. He's included in the historical books of 1 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles. He appears in later historical books, Ezra, Nehemiah and Esther mention him. He's also mentioned in prophecies like Jeremiah we've just been looking at, and particularly in the prophecy of Daniel. I just want to share one particular reference about him, and hopefully you'll see why. So picking up in Daniel 4, a narrative, all this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built? for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honour of my majesty. And what's fascinating is that the archaeological team really felt that that was the case, that they were digging up a city that Nebuchadnezzar had been responsible for building. Even though it existed a long, long time before that, he had so restructured it that it was like it was his city, with his name stamped on everything. So again, note that the Bible's record is closely corroborated by independent archaeological finds. And we can see that it's correct when it records the names of the kings involved and the connected details of their reign, just in passing sometimes. And this is not a one-off. Bricks bearing the names of other kings mentioned in the Bible have been found. Assyrian kings like Shalmaneser, Sargon, Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, and a Persian king, Cyrus. So there is plenty of evidence in other places we could be looking at. Time's fast disappearing, so let's just jump into the New Testament part of our Bibles, just consider a couple more precious discoveries. And the first one I want us to think about is Pilate's inscription. Now, not long ago, many scholars were questioning the existence of a Roman governor with the name Pontius Pilate. This is the man who is recorded in the Bible as the Roman official who ordered Jesus' crucifixion. So he's a key part of the Bible narrative in the New Testament. But it was a big question mark over whether he ever existed. But interestingly, in June 1961, Italian archaeologists, led by Dr. Antonio Frova, were excavating an ancient Roman amphitheatre near Caesarea on Sea, within Israel. And there they uncovered an interesting limestone block, and that's again now housed in the Israel Museum. And on the face of the block is an inscription, part of a dedication to Tiberius Caesar, and it says, "Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, has dedicated to the people of Caesarea a temple in honour of Tiberius." Again, not a lot of text, succinct, a fair bit of detail there, but let's just bring, again, a very small part of the Bible with succinct detail in it, put it alongside, because it almost perfectly matches what we read of Luke's account of the Gospel. And he, just starting a narrative, giving a bit of historical context, writes, "Now in the 15th year of the reign of Caesar, Pontius Pilate, being governor of Judea," and then he goes on to give a few other historical details which we don't need to think about. But look at that, how they absolutely match each other. Governor, prefect. In some versions you'll actually see the word prefect being used in the Bible. So it's exactly the same term. So again, see how the Pilate inscription supports the Bible. It states that Pontius Pilate was the governor, was the prefect of Judea, just one little part of the Roman Empire, at exactly the right time in the reign of the Emperor Tiberius Caesar. Just as the Bible says, just as the inscription says. Well, our last artifact is a coin. You can't really talk about archaeology without having a coin in there somewhere, can you? So here it comes. And the picture I want to show you there is of a Greek coin minted at a place called Ephesus, which you could go to now. It's in Turkey. The one side of the coin you can see features portraits of the Emperor Claudius and his wife behind him, Agrippina the Younger. Fascinating name, I like that. On the on the reverse side of the coin, there is an image of the statue of the goddess Diana of the Ephesians. The words Diana Ephesia are there on the coin. Again, this relates very well to an episode recorded in the book of the Acts of the Apostles in our New Testament. This is a time when the teachings of Jesus were being spread from Jerusalem outwards across the Roman Empire in the first century AD. Now, the preaching of the Apostle Paul in Ephesus was against this false goddess, Diana, who's also known as Artemis. His words caused an uproar among the silversmiths, who made their living by producing souvenirs of her for people who came to visit her temple. And the Bible tells us that the silversmiths made this complaint. They said, so not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worship. Now when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, great is Diana of the Ephesians. Diana Ephesia. Now again, just look at the incidental nature of that archaeological find, because it's confirming the Bible record. It shows that Diana of the Ephesians was a popular goddess in Ephesus at the right historical period when Paul is claimed to have been there doing his preaching work. And it matches up, because there, the silversmiths say that she was so important that the whole world practically worshipped this person. So of course she would be important enough to feature on the back of coins and be celebrated in that way by the imperial mint. It matches perfectly, doesn't it? So we've looked at six examples to try and show that the Bible is accurate when it records information about people and places that it talks about. We've tried to cover a different range of artifacts across different countries, with different time periods. But what we also need to remember is that many other discoveries support the Bible record too. All those pictures you saw earlier are connected in some way to the Bible and support it. And there are many more we could put up there. So where does that leave us? If we remember that there are these many discoveries that support the Bible, what are the implications of all this? If the Bible's record is confirmed, then what of the message contained in its pages? You see, just like the archaeologist in the field, the reader of the Bible has to do some digging. It's not an easy book to read at times, and sometimes you have to dig quite deeply to find what's hidden within it, to search out the precious things that are waiting in it to be discovered. And it requires effort, and an archaeological dig is a hard place to work. And sometimes so can be reading our Bibles. But the Bible declares that if we're prepared to apply ourselves, there is treasure to be found within it. Now Paul, that man who was preaching and causing such an uproar in Ephesus by what he was saying, wrote other words. A lot of our New Testament was written by him. And he wrote to another group of believers in a nearby city to Ephesus, a place called Colossae. And perhaps if you've got a Bible, you wouldn't mind just turning with me now as we bring our thoughts to a close and just looking at one passage in particular. And it's an intriguing passage, one I want to leave with you to pick over. Now, we're looking at Colossians, and Colossians, as I say, is in your New Testament. So if you can find your New Testament, you work through the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, past the Acts of the Apostles we were looking at, and then you're into the letters of Paul. And you've got to keep going past Romans, Corinthians, past Galatians and Ephesians and Philippians. And eventually, you should find yourself at Colossians. Just don't go past it into Thessalonians or further. Now, Colossians 1. We're jumping into a passage, so forgive that. But just look at what we're reading there when we pick it up. Paul's writing in verse 25. Paul says, I am made a minister. A servant, someone who is ministering something, according to the dispensation of God, which is given to me for you. So God has given me, has dispensed on me, this service that I must provide. He says, what is it? To fulfill the word of God. Even the mystery which hath been hid from ages and from generations. Sounding a bit like an archaeologist having to reveal something that's been hidden, doesn't it? But he says, but now is made manifest to his saints, is to be brought out into the open to saints, to believers, to whom God would make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, the non-Jews. And then he tells us what that mystery is that he's trying to bring out into the open for us to share, this rich mystery which is no longer to be a mystery. What is it?
which is Christ in you, the hope of glory, whom we preach, warning every man and teaching every man in all wisdom, that we may present every man perfect in Christ Jesus. Now that's a fairly enigmatic passage. You have to do quite a bit of digging to understand what Paul's really getting at there. But I'm just going to say, is that a precious discovery that you feel you would like to make? If so, trust this book enough to read it and give it a chance. Thank you.